All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, and really glad to have you on board. I have a bit of a scratchy throat. I don't know. Can you hear that? Can you? You don't hear that? I feel it. And I get sick so rarely, and I'm just going to man up here for the next hour, and I think it's going to work out okay. I'm drinking my water, and probably might be better tomorrow, but I'm not too bad, and I almost never get knocked off my feet, but I can hear it there. I can just go and scratch, scratch, scratch. Anyway, I'm glad you're here, even with my scratchy voice, and had a wonderful hour just with my brother, most of it, and another caller. And since we had so many people been calling in, I'm not going to do an opening commentary this hour. I'm just going to jump right in because so many are in the queue. So let's do that. And we are going, this is a kind of a flash in the past for me, to Lansing, Michigan. And it's Aaron. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Greg. I'm a bio graduate and I'm a missionary at Michigan State University.
Oh, my goodness. See, that's my, does it count as an alma mater if you only went there but didn't graduate? Or is,
I heard your story, and it was really cool. So, yeah, I'm here doing God's work, so it's awesome.
Okay, well, I spent 2 years at Michigan State University, 1970 to 72, and before I came out to California. I didn't graduate from there, but there was, like, about 6 months that I was a cabbie in Lansing, so I used to know the city pretty well, but that was a long, long time ago. Anyway, glad to hear from you, and I'm glad you're a missionary there at Michigan State University. That's where Gary Habermas got his PhD, by the way. Did you know that?
Yeah, I use his work to people I witness there all the time.
Uh-huh.
So my question is, I have an Asian lady that came to Christ, and she's going back to her country.
Oh.
And there's no, she has no Christian community, no church. She has absolutely nothing.
Which country is it? Can you tell me?
Yeah, sure, China.
Okay. Well, and she doesn't know of one, but there are a whole lot of Christians there. For I know that for sure.
Yeah, so she came to Christ, and I've discipled her, and I want to bring her back to her country with some really good Christian books. Do you have any Christian books that would be at her? Well, her English is moderate. It can't be too deep, but it's got to be deep enough that it would be something she could take with her for the rest of her life.
Well,
recommendation?
Right. Well, you know, it's always a liability. I was chuckling a moment ago to ask an author if he has any good books that he can recommend for somebody like that. And see, here's the, let me just, I think what your dear Christian disciple needs is something foundational to build a good solid foundation. And something theologically foundational is what I mean. And also, maybe you know where I'm going with this. If she's going to be engaging with people spiritually, then it's good that she learns some skill in maneuvering in conversations. That's why when anybody asks me for a recommendation of books for broadly the kind of thing you're describing, I think the language issue and the culture issue I want to comment about in a minute, but I always recommend The Story of Reality because it was my attempt, and I'm embarrassed to say this to you, but I mean, I think there are other books that have foundational stuff in there, but I don't think they're any better than what I've done in terms of explaining this stuff, and if they're, and maybe not as good. So if they're no better, if I knew one that was better than that one, I would recommend it. But I wrote this book on purpose. I should say, of course, I wrote it on purpose with the purpose of meeting a niche, of filling a niche that maybe 50 years ago Mere Christianity filled, but that. It, as popular as it is today in many circles, there are a lot of people who are just not going to rise to the level of C.S. Lewis. And so I'm not trying to equate myself with Lewis, but I'm saying I'm trying to meet a need that that book met, but by telling the story in a certain sense, a simpler fashion, to making it more accessible to more people, but still being true to the substance. And he also goes into a speculation, a lot of other things in his book. There's a lot more detail. I just stick with five things: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection, and it truly is a mere Christianity treatment because anybody who is in any genuinely Christian denomination, whatever, would agree with virtually everything that I've written. There's nothing controversial there. The question is whether even though I think the style is very accessible, whether she would be able to read that material adequately to understand it. And that's something that only you could decide. What do you think?
Well, I've read the book, and it's excellent, so I really think that's a great recommendation. Yes, I do think that it would be a great book for her.
Like I said, if I knew of something different, you know, I would recommend it. Let me think. There's a, I know this may even sound patronizing, but there's a children's book that has great pictures and stuff in it, but written by a former East Lansing resident, Kevin DeYoung. And he's now in North Carolina in Charlotte area, but he was a pastor there in East Lansing. Now, this book has the story told very simply with very interesting graphics. She may want to take that with her. I'm sure she's above and beyond that, but it would be the kind of thing that somebody could help. Okay, it's called The Biggest Story. Is that it? The Biggest Story, yeah, by Kevin DeYoung.
And, yeah, that's excellent. That's great. I've actually given that to her daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's two recommendations I've already given her. Can you think of any other Christian book or theological book that would be?
Well, I was going to also recommend Tactics too, but because of the practical nature of being able to maneuver in conversations, let me just think. Most of the theological works that I'm familiar with are that gives the basics, and I think basics are really important, are generally not so down-to-earth and accessible when English is your second language. There's the classic Know What You Believe by Paul Little. He's an Englishman. Sure. Know What You Believe, and that's not a very large book, but it's been around forever. I presume it's still in print. Amy's probably checking it out right now. Paul Little's Know What You Believe, is that still in print? Yeah, she's checking it out right now, but it probably is. And I only recommend that one because, yeah, it's still, Amy gives a thumbs up there, it's still in print. I recommend it because it covers the basics, and as I recall, it's been ages since I read it. Gotcha. There's a Know What You Believe and a Know Why You Believe, and I knew about that other one too. I don't know if the Know Why You Believe, that's also probably 50 years old, and so it may be that newer apologetics books are going to give information that would be more helpful to her. Of course, it's hard to tell. You know, in China, she's not facing the... I don't know. Maybe she's not facing the kind of challenges that we're facing in Western civilization now. Although China is very cosmopolitan, you know, the cities are, and it's very westernized in many ways. But it's something simpler, like Paul Little's "Know What You Believe and Why You Believe." Those separate titles, that might be another option. There's a wonderful book. This isn't theological, but just to think about. I mean, it has theology in, but it's a different kind of book. It's about discipleship, and it's called The Master Plan of Discipleship. And I was taught through this book when I was a brand new Christian, and it's about making other disciples. And if she's your disciple, for her to take with her a fairly straightforward book on how she could reproduce herself might be helpful. And I actually just yesterday checked the top evangelism books, and I think on Amazon, at top 10, I was number 10 for Tactics. But I think The Master Plan for Evangelism was in that grouping, either top 10 or top 20. So this is written by Robert Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, and like I said, it's probably close to 50 years old. But it's still doing well for a good reason. It's a very good, handy kind of manual of how to disciple by following the plan of the Master himself, Jesus of Nazareth. So,
those are excellent. What is your favorite book besides what you've written in the Bible? What is your personal favorite book?
Wait, say it again. It's a little slower. My favorite book for what?
besides the Bible and, of course, books you've written, what is personally your favorite?
You mean defending the authority of the Bible?
No, any Christian book. What is your favorite Christian book that someone's written?
My favorite Christian book across the board, kind of.
Yes.
Gosh, this is... wow. Okay, I'm going to hazard a comment here. First of all, the author C.S. Lewis, and his work is so unbelievably timeless. It's so good, even though he's been dead for 50 years. And so I'm just going to say The Chronicles of Narnia.
Okay.
I know that sounds, oh my gosh, I didn't expect him to say that. There is so much rich theology in The Chronicles of Narnia, and richness that has to do with living as a Christian. Okay. But you're in narrative form. It's these stories that are fetching and they're fun and they're easy to read. And if you're not alert to it, you're going to miss some of these things. And it's okay. They're still fun to read. It's kind of like Lewis said when he started writing them, he wrote them for some of his maybe younger relatives or something. And he said, now by the time I'm done writing these, you're too old and you have to wait and live a little longer before they'll be meaningful to you again. So it's almost like for the real young, they take it on one level, but the older Christian takes it on a different level, and that's me. And so just take The Horse and the Boy, for example. This is a story about hardship that befalls an individual and who suffers all his life, only to learn at the end of his life what the purpose of all the suffering was. I mean, that's one takeaway from that book.
Right.
And it's magnificently done by Lewis. And I have been deeply encouraged with regards to that particular lesson by the narrative of this boy who's a Kellerman, a young Kellerman boy, and or thinks he is, spoiler alert, anyway, who then finds himself towards the end of the book, woe is me, lost in the woods. And then Aslan visits him and then points out all these things that he had done all along the way that brought him to this point of ultimate destiny in his life. And what that destiny was, I won't tell you, because that's how the ending unfolds. It's the climax of the book. But I just use that as an illustration to show the incredible richness that has come out of the Chronicles and how much it has... brought satisfaction to my own heart. It isn't like a systematic theology, but he tells the truth. You know, in the Chronicles, whenever anybody goes anywhere, it takes a long, long time. Have you read the Chronicles or any of them?
Yes. I read them as a little boy, and I remember
Time for a second time around. And you can go on Amazon and get the Focus on the Family set of CDs of them. And those are animated. I mean, those are like, that's the one to listen to because, I mean, if you're just going to listen, sorry, Amy just corrected me. It's dramatized, not animated. Animations would look a little silly. We like the movies too, pretty much, though there's more liberty taken. But if you listen to the dramatized ones, it's the book that's being read. So the books. And it's so wonderful. They're so rich. So, but when anybody travels anywhere, it takes a long, long time. They're walking for weeks and weeks and weeks before they get to where the Emerald Chair is, or whatever that the prince is captured in, or whatever, you know, or they're sailing when the voyage of the Lawn Treader for weeks and weeks. Because I think Lewis is telling us something about the nature of the Christian life. It's a plodding enterprise. So anyway, so there's my answer. I'm going to have to break off here, Aaron, but from Lansing. But I hope you already have the books. You already have the young book and given it to the family. So I think your instincts are pretty good on this.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate your ministry.
Okay, Aaron. All the best to you. And let's break now. Shall we break?
Yeah.
or keep rolling? What do you, okay, Amy. Amy's the boss, so she says keep going. And this is Sam from Houston. That's twice in, like, what, 2 weeks, Sam?
Nope, different Sam.
Oh, different Sam. Oh, okay. Well, I'm taking a sigh of relief because the other Sam's a toughie. But, all right.
I met you once in Calgary a few years back.
Oh,
and
no
I asked
kidding.
You a really silly question. I don't remember what it was.
Oh, okay. Well, I probably gave you a silly answer, but I don't remember what that was either.
It was a great answer.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah.
Question.
All right. So, so I've been Christian all my life and never been baptized. And this came to the front of my mind a few weeks ago. Uh-huh. We were talking to somebody about baptism.
We were talking then about rebaptism, right?
Yes. And I've discussed this with heatedly at times with a bunch of friends in my church. And I don't see where the Bible would command me to be baptized. Because to me, it seems that baptism is commanded at conversion, right? It's repent and be baptized. If there isn't that event, so to speak, then it doesn't seem that there's an impetus to be baptized.
Right. Well, if there wasn't an event, then you're not a Christian. Now, let me qualify it. That doesn't mean you remember the event, but you started out dead, and now you're alive, spiritually speaking.
No, no.
So the birth had to happen somewhere
that.
Along the line. So you are a convert.
Yeah.
Every Christian is a convert in one sense of the word.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Okay.
But I also think that it's inappropriate to baptize a child who doesn't really understand.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Okay, but but you're not a child. You are somebody who has come to Christ.
Right.
Okay, because there was when you were not regenerate, and now you are. So that means there was a moment when the rebirth took place, and subsequent to the rebirth, you are to be baptized. The group in the book of Acts were told to be baptized right then. Repent, change your mind, is what he had in mind there, and
right.
Be baptized and receive the gift of the Spirit and, you know, other things. Okay, there are other theological realities there. I'm convinced, because of what the Bible teaches, that the Spirit doesn't come upon baptism. But the baptism was happening when they were being converted, and so the Spirit is being given to them at that moment. But the baptism was still important. In your case, it just hasn't happened yet. So you're not a new convert. You are an older convert who has not done what a new convert is supposed to do. And so you should do it.
So there isn't, it seems to me like they should be connected. But
well, they are connected. They are
right,
connected. Are you?
What I mean is that there wasn't a point in time where it was appropriate to say, well, I'm converting now,
right.
Therefore I should be baptized
Sure,
now.
I understand. They are not necessarily temporally connected. That is, sometimes you become a Christian, and then you get baptized, and then you develop in your Christian life. But some people haven't done it, don't have that sequence like that, and you're one of them. But it doesn't change the fact that we are Great Commission, making disciples, baptizing. So disciples are baptized. If you consider yourself a disciple of Christ, then you should be baptized. If you're a follower of Christ, you should be baptized. Paul talks in the past tense there in Romans 6 about those who are baptized into Christ are such and so, and so he gives a picture of what baptism is meant to demonstrate, which has taken place in your life, yet at the same time you haven't been baptized. And I think you need to close the loop. Why wouldn't you be?
Well, it just, I don't know, it doesn't seem appropriate to me in the same way that rebaptism doesn't, or a similar way anyway.
Okay. Well,
and that it doesn't seem like baptism is supposed to symbolize certain things happening in a new believer's life.
Have happened.
Yes.
Have happened. And generally, the baptism symbolized what just had happened, if this baptism was soon. But it sometimes it isn't. what just had happened. In your case, it hasn't just had happened because you didn't get baptized then. For whatever reason, it's not your fault. I'm not saying that. But the New Testament does not know anything about non-baptized believers. It isn't like
right.
baptism just happened at the beginning when you first, and if you didn't do it, no big deal.
Right.
So I think that you're, when I say why not, and you say because it's not right at the same time of my conversion, that's not a requirement. It isn't like, okay, you didn't get it done last week when you became a Christian, so too late now, so never mind. The
right.
thing is, it's not last week, it's last couple years or whatever it's been in your case, so you just waited longer. But that does not disqualify the responsibility of being baptized. It's still there. It's kind of like a common law marriage, you know. you're de facto married, but, you know, let's make an honest woman out of her and walk down the aisle and make your pledge in front of everybody. So a little bit late, maybe, in that case, but still, at least you close the loop. And I would suggest that you close the loop.
Oh, that's a good analogy. Thanks.
Well, I hope it's persuasive because, you know, it is very rare that I run into somebody who is resisting, and it does seem to me a little bit to you like you're resisting, though you're saying, well, what does it matter? I said, well, if Jesus said to do it, well, it seemed like they did it at conversion. I know, but that it didn't. They did back then, but that isn't a qualifier to baptism, so best thing to do is just do it. What's the harm done? You know, it's not, the Bible isn't against it. It isn't like there's something inappropriate. It's what disciples are supposed to have done.
I guess it's partly that my church has always put a whole bunch of ceremony around it. And
okay, what's wrong with that?
Well,
there's nothing
wrong with the ceremony per se.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're not persuading me. I'm just letting you know, but go ahead.
Oh, no, I know I'm not persuading you. I can tell.
Okay, let me offer this thought. My daughter, I'm pretty convinced my 11-year-old knows the Lord, but she hasn't been baptized yet. And the reason that she hasn't been baptized, here's what she told me. And she's not listening to this because she doesn't listen to the show, so it doesn't matter. But the reason that she's not been baptized is because she doesn't want to stand up in front of a whole bunch of people she doesn't know and kind of say this stuff because it just makes her feel uncomfortable. And so we've talked a little bit about instead of doing the thing at our local church where they have the deal and they wheel out the jacuzzi and all
right.
of that stuff. And that's what we did with my 14-year-old, who was 6 at the time. We can just, you know, maybe meet as a family and some closer friends at somebody's house and do it in a pool, you know. And so this sounds more appealing to her because of her discomfort with the kind of big, giant Falderas scene. There'd be a celebration of sorts that are associated with it, and that's appropriate. But it won't be with a bunch of people who are strangers. Is that something that might sound more appealing to you?
Oh, no, it's not. It's not that I have any form of, you know, stage fright or something like that. It just feels that, I don't know, that it's, you know, because it's not connected temporally with conversion, it seems kind of out of step with, you know, whoever else is getting baptized.
Well, that may be true, but it's not entirely true. It's only out of step in the sense that there's been a delay, but it turns out, you know, and here Brooke's sitting across, she's across the window from me, and Brooke's dad is my pastor. You know, you've sat through many, many baptisms, right, Brooke? Is it not the case, because I've seen them too, that lots of people that get baptized, oh, Amy's raising her hand. What's the matter with you, Amy? Oh, okay. Amy says she was baptized as an infant, but were you rebaptized, so to speak, a long time after you had conscious awareness of being a father? There you go. Here's Amy, the Amy Hall. She's in the same situation that you were in, except for I don't know about the infant baptism part. But she'd been a conscious adult Christian for a long time before she got baptized. And Brooke is telling me, yeah, again, this happens all the time. There's lots of people that say, yeah, I've been a Christian for a long time, but I never got around to this, and I should have done it earlier, but now I'm you know, making an honest person out of myself, so to speak. So look at, so you are not, it's a little bit humbling to do that, but I think you're going to be around other people. And by the way, that's part of the point. When you go down and under, you're not in control of that. You know, the pastor's taking you down and bringing you back up. And but you're not going to be, I promise you, if you do it as part of your larger church ceremony, like when a lot of people, here's the Sunday where 15 people are getting baptized, I guarantee you, you will not be the only one that didn't just come to Christ. In fact, I bet you the majority are going to be, will have been Christians for a while, and they're finally getting around to baptism.
Okay.
All right? Okay, Sam, do me a favor.
Yep.
Give me a call after your baptism.
Okay.
All right. Tell me how it went.
I can do that. Sure.
All right, brother. Good talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, that was interesting. Amy, I didn't know that about Amy. But Brooke, you've seen, yes, of course, she's like, lots and lots of, I think, I kind of have a sense, unless they're children, when I say children, I mean like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old who are making a conscious decision for Christ or have just done that. A good number of the adults turn out to be people who just haven't gotten around to this yet, and now they're getting straightened out. All right. Shall we keep going? Okay, we'll keep going, and we'll have a break here. Let me just a second. I have Dave here in Union, Kentucky. Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to talk to you.
Nice talking to you, too.
Yeah. I got a question. I attend the Methodist Church here.
Okay.
My wife and I attend the Methodist Church.
Is it the United
Church
Methodist?
United Methodist.
Okay.
And they've had a lot of controversy going on for 6, 7, 8 years. And
yeah.
I'm sure you know that last week, and it was a surprise to me, but they actually passed the traditional plan.
Yes.
Which means that they current statements about homosexuality and same-sex marriage and ordination of LGBTQ, and the only reason I know that is because I wrote it down.
Mm-hmm.
Persons are, you know, it's not fundamentally changing. Uh-huh. And here's my issue. She and I, she's a wonderful woman, Greg, but she and I fall on the opposite ends of this issue.
Okay.
You know, I have a more classical view of the scriptures, and I honestly have a problem with someone trying to rewrite what the Bible says.
Right.
Well, I think the progressives are doing in the Methodist Church.
I think you're right on that, by the way.
Well, thank you. But on the other hand, as I said, she's a wonderful person. She's got a lot of love in her heart. And this has just torn her up. And she's told me that she's not going to go back to our church, and that she'd like for us to find another church that's mutually compatible. And I don't know what in the world that's going to be, because you know I have a classical view of
right.
You know, whatever the moral issues are, whether it be homosexuality or you know, whatever it might be.
Does she differ with you on other issues like this?
No. No.
So she's not pro-abortion necessarily or any of these other kinds of things that might
fall? Greg, she is the most pro-life person you can imagine. I mean, it's just...
Okay, well, that's good.
It's just one issue.
Okay. Now, okay, here's the deal. A couple of thoughts. And one of them is, first of all, my heart goes out to you because I just could hear your heart in this, your love for your wife, your respect for your wife, and then how it tears you up that you're at odds over this issue. I'm not sure how many people are following entirely, but United Methodist Church last week decided to hold the line on a classical view regarding homosexuality. And I don't know if it was about, and you can tell me this, Dave, whether it was on same-sex marriage or practicing homosexuals in the church or in the clergy, but at some point they just said, no, we're not going any further on this one.
Yeah, all of it.
All of it. Okay, so they're holding to the traditional, let me back up and choose a different word. They're holding to the biblical view on marriage and sex.
That's a good word.
Okay.
Biblical. But
United Methodist Church, and I tip my hat to them because, you know, they're a little here and a little there, and it's been a concern over the last couple of years. Okay, yeah, it was a surprise to everybody. Okay, now, so people are up to speed on what this issue is and what's going on. The difficulty is what you asked for is, or what she has asked for is a church which is, the doctrine is mutually compatible to both of you. And no church can avoid this issue nowadays. It has been, we have had our face, it's been thrust into our faces so aggressively that no church can avoid it. And the church is either going to say aye or nay to the classical view. And if it says aye to the classical view, your wife isn't going to be happy with it, like she's not happy with the church you're at now, which, by the way, is somewhat left-leaning, generally speaking, you know, in many ways. And a lot depends on the individual church, but especially on the West Coast, the United Methodist Church is very left-leaning. But if you're looking for something conservative, she's not going to go with a conservative view, obviously, on homosexuality. So if they say I said aye or nay, if they say aye to the classical view, she's not going to go. If they say nay to the classical view, in other words, you go to a church that affirms. It's an affirming church, so to speak. Well, that's not going to be good for you. I don't know if you can find a church in which you will be mutually acceptable.
I think it's impossible.
So, but I have another. There's another question I have. From what you've said, it seems like in all these other really important areas that have to do with Jesus and or the abortion, other ethical issues, she is really solid. Why? It makes me wonder why this one, because faithfulness in this regard, and I've said this many times, is not theologically complicated. Being faithful to Scripture on the sexual issues is not theologically complicated because the theology is really clear in the Bible. So I don't know why she's balking, and it can't be because of the Bible. When people balk at what the Bible says and try to reinterpret it, it's because of some other reason. Something else has happened.
Are you familiar with Adam Hamilton, the Methodist preacher at the Church of the Resurrection in Kansas City, or Matthew Vines?
Matthew Vines, I'm very familiar with Matthew Vines. But if they're of the same ilk...
They are.
Okay, well, see, look at what Matthew Vines... Okay, I'm not dismissing, this isn't a genetic fallacy, all right? Matthew Vines is a homosexual. He has something at stake here. The Scriptures are not tricky. They are very clear. Matthew Vines' explanations or dismissals, as the case may be, or reinterpretation of all of those texts that have to do with homosexuality are among the lamest arguments that I have ever heard. All right.
I know that.
Okay, so
I know that.
But so then, if the arguments are so lame, then why does Matthew Vines? I almost said Matthew Shepard. Why does Matthew Vines believe in him? Because he's got something at stake that causes him to accept bad arguments, and a lot of the theologians that are on his team, they were conservative on the issue until their family members came out as gay, and then all of a sudden they're changing their tune. The Bible hasn't changed. Their private circumstances have changed. So this is why I'm asking, I'm curious, and maybe there's nothing here, but I'm wondering if there's something else lurking beneath the surface with your wife that makes her so adamant. You said she doesn't just disagree. She doesn't even want to go back to that church, so she's got something strong. She has some strong, I think, inordinate reaction to this. And, remember Shakespeare, someone in Shakespeare said, "Methinks thou dost protest too much." Right?
So I think perhaps.
Yeah. So I don't know. This is something you can explore. Maybe she has a really close friend that
she
is.
Does.
Well, and so she's
and
taking.
An uncle.
Pardon me?
A dead uncle that she dearly loved.
Oh, an uncle. Oh, yeah. So she's taking...
Oh, and a friend that has a lesbian daughter.
Okay, so she's
taking...
That
she dearly loves.
She's taking umbrage on behalf of those people. And that's what... It just seems like you put your finger on it. That's what's going on here. And God bless her for her affections towards her friends. But remember, love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, 1 Corinthians 13. And if we are loving towards people, then we're going to want the best for them. And homosexuality is not the best for them. So, especially homosexuality.
When I explain that to her, I'm preaching at her.
Yeah.
You know, her view is that she thinks those of us with a classical viewpoint of sexual immorality are misinterpreting the scriptures, because that's what she gets from this guy.
Yeah. Okay. Here's my recommendation. Right. Okay. Let me give you a quick book recommendation. Then I have to move on. I got a bunch of people on hold here. But it's a book by Kevin DeYoung. Kevin, Kevin DeYoung, DeYoung. And the book is titled, Amy, help me out. I think it's What the Bible Really Teaches About Homosexuality. I think it's a very straightforward title, and it's a slim book. It's not really complete. It's not fancy. He gets right to the heart of the issues, and he's very, very good. Okay? And you could also, so this will just help you get a clear idea of the text and what the text teaches. The Bible has nothing good to say about homosexuality. Every time it comes up in a negative context. Okay? There is no indication in these major passages like Romans 1 that what is going on there is an abusive kind of master-slave relationship or anything like that. It is the two people that are doing it together. That's why they're both condemned. It's in the passage, okay? So anyway, I think that's a good little primer that will help with the biblical issue. And Alan Schliemann and I have co-authored a piece that you can find on our website, and I think the name of it is, it's dealing with Matthew Vines and his view, and it's called...
Yeah, I've read it. Wonderful.
Yeah, okay. A Reformation...
My wife's not buying it.
Yeah, a Reformation the Church Doesn't Need is the title of it. But okay, it looks like you've jumped through all the hoops. And I'm sorry, brother, I can't help you anymore. It's a tough situation.
I mean, she thinks the Methodists are making homosexual second-class citizens.
I don't see how that follows in the slightest bit, any more than we make heterosexuals who are in sexual sin second-class citizens. Adulterers?
I agree with you, okay. But I can't get her to.
Maybe this is one of those cases only God can do that. And boy, I've faced circumstances like that in my life, and all we can do is really pray really hard. I don't mean that. It's kind of like pat answer. It comes at the end of all our discussion. So sometimes that's all we're left with. Thank you, Dave, for your call. I'm sorry about your situation. I hope you take it to the Lord. Okay. We keep going, huh? No commercials this hour? All right. Let's go to Chino. Let me find it here. Chino, California. Aaron, hi.
Hello, Brother Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
Brother Aaron, you're welcome. What church do you go to in Chino?
You've actually come to our church numerous times. First United Reformed Church of Chino. You've spoken at our church a few times.
Oh, okay. Good. All right, great. Glad to chat with you.
Yes, likewise. I really appreciate your careful thinking on a whole host of matters, and this is why I'm calling you with this question. It's something I've been thinking about often. In terms of being a citizen, a Christian citizen in any nation, for instance, ours, I know it's very clear the scriptures teach that we're called to disobey the civil authorities whenever they command us to do something God forbids, and we're supposed to disobey them when they command us to do something. Well, the other way around. We're supposed to disobey the government whenever they command us to do something God forbids or forbid us to do something that God commands. Now, with that in mind, I thought of an analogy, hypothetically, like if I was perhaps a Christian citizen, living in the Nazi Third Reich,
mm-hmm.
living next to the Dachau death camp or Buchenwald, whatever, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the line drawn in terms of, If I wanted, if when are we obligated to sabotage a murder mill, for instance, like an abortion mill? I'm trying to draw an analogy between the two.
I know you're going, and it's a fair question, yeah. And it's obviously one I've asked myself, too, and had to struggle with, because there have been occasions where there have been killings of abortion doctors, okay? And
real quick, that's not what I mean. I mean more of a sabotaging the institution itself, for instance, the plumbing or the infrastructure, just to prevent the perpetuation of the murder of the innocent.
Yeah.
In other words, not murdering, but doing everything you can to prevent the continual murder of the whatever is being done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a little different kind of question, and I don't think I have an answer for you here. And here's the difficulty for me in a public position. Even speaking theoretically about this, my words could be construed as encouraging people to break the law.
Right.
Okay. And in a violent kind of fashion. Okay. And I think there are, in a certain sense, prudential considerations for all of these kinds of things. And one of them is the social fabric and the social contract that I think morality is not reduced to a social contract, but there is a social contract that helps sustain our society in a certain way.
Correct.
And so that has to be taken into consideration.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, the goal of doing this is to, presumably, is to stop killing. But it may turn out that it only results in more deaths in the long term, okay? Because babies that, I'm just speaking practically here, so people can just do the math. They think that maybe doing sabotage or something like that is going to stop abortions. Well, the people who are going to get abortions are probably would just move to a different location and those same babies would be killed. That's one thing. Secondly, what our goal is to be able to bring the masses, or at least my goal, the masses along to understand how gruesome an act abortion is, what it actually does. It takes the life of an innocent child, and then have the culture be able to move to put an end to this. If we do actions, and I'm not only talking on a pragmatic basis here, if we do actions then that get in the way of that process and put more people against us rather than for us, then what we have done is we have cost more babies' lives than we've saved in the long run. And so I'm not giving you an answer regarding the specifics. I'm saying these are the kind of factors that need to be considered whenever anybody makes a decision like this. In fact, it's also the kind of decision that we make in wartime, where lives are at stake, and where do you know there's a famous example? I'm trying to remember the city. During the Second World War, we broke the code. Actually, the Brits broke the Enigma code, and they knew that a certain city was going to be bombed. But Churchill did not send out a warning.
I heard about that. Yeah,
Coventry is the name of the city, and the reason is if they sent out a warning that Coventry was going to be bombed, that would alert the Germans that the code had been broken, and they'd do something else. They would lose their advantage. And so there are these are very complex kinds of questions that need to
be
asked, and they're very difficult to work out.
Right, exactly.
That's why you brought it to me. Stick me with the hard one, right?
Yeah, I like your thinking. You're very careful thinking. I appreciate you. You're finished in that regard.
And what I'm doing is just kind of outlining the kinds of considerations that need to be taken into place to be considered, or you know, and I'm not making any recommendations. So
exactly.
As long as you understand that, okay?
All right.
Aaron, gotta go. Thank you, brother.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Hey, just a reminder, we've got two rethinks coming up in the next 2 months, actually 1 and 2 weeks, right? About 2.5 or 3 weeks, Dallas. That's March 29th and 30th. And we have then the following month in April 26th and 27th, we'll be in Birmingham. Of course, many of you know about these because we've been talking about them a lot. And the Rethink is, of course, Rethink Apologetics Student Conferences. These are magnificent events. Long Friday evening and then all day, long day Saturday. Doesn't matter. The kids love them. When we open the doors, they just plow down to the front rows to get the best seats because they're thrilled to be part of what we're doing with the conferences. We bring in our best talent, our best speakers. We bring in our best worship team. There's lots of fun things that happen, but we're down to business when it comes to the instruction because we're not dumbing it down for anyone. These kids don't need to be dumbed down. They need to be hardcore taught how to defend their faith, and so that's what we do. Let's see. You can the Dallas event coming up the 29th and 30th is... you know what I need is I need a fact sheet for each of the events that has all of the facts on them because I can't remember them where it's at. You can get the information here at rethinkapologetics.com, rethinkapologetics.com. And you'll have the information about Dallas. You'll have the information about Birmingham coming up April 26th and 27th. And by the way, we're still inside of the early bird sign-up for Birmingham. So you can save a few bucks if you sign up in advance. We're over 1,000 people signed up 3 weeks in advance now for the Dallas event, but we have plenty of room to expand, so check that out. And in Orange County, it's September 27th and 28th, and then our first ever Midwest Rethink Conference, November 8th and 9th in the fall at Minneapolis. So all the details are at rethinkapologetics.com. All right, let's quickly go to Elk Grove, California, and wait, that's the wrong button. And Richard.
Yes, hi, Greg.
You? Hi there. Is Elk Grove like north of Sacramento?
South.
South
it's
of Sacramento.
South of Sacramento.
Okay, good. Glad to have you.
Okay, I appreciate your ministry.
Thank you. You're so welcome.
For a long, long time.
Right, thank you.
Okay, and I want to talk to you about a social contract theory.
Okay.
We have a... what you call meetup groups up here, and I go to one, a multi-belief meetup group.
Okay.
And that's the subject for this Saturday.
All right.
And just wondering what I might run into, and any suggestions on how to dialogue.
Let me quickly recommend, we deal with this in the Relativism book, Frank Beckwith and I. It's a section I wrote. It's called Conventionalism, and it's the idea that let me back up for a second and kind of put this, kind of give you a context. These kinds of theories, like social contract, are attempts at trying to explain the moral project.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So human beings are beings that act with moral intention. We use moral language. We have moral codes and all that. So what's that all about? Is the question philosophically, and one answer coming from people like Jeremy Bentham or Rousseau hundreds of years ago, is that really what morality is a way of implicitly agreeing to right and wrong concepts so that we all basically get along. Because if we didn't agree to some things, and then we would be in a mess, okay? And so we have this social contract. It's implicit. It's
right.
It's not anywhere, but it's resident in our awarenesses of what we think are right and wrong. And different cultures kind of have different awarenesses of that, and so there are variations in the so-called social contract. Okay, so here's a couple of questions that I would raise regarding the social contract.
Okay.
I'd ask for clarification. Basically, on this view, and so this is what you want to get the people to feed you who are in favor of this notion or talking about it. So what morality is what the culture agrees to.
Right.
So that's a kind of majority rules idea. All right?
Yeah.
So here's a question. What do you do with a moral reformer? Okay, so who would be a moral reformer? Martin Luther King, for example, or William Wilberforce. Now, what is unique about a moral, what is distinctive about a moral reformer? moral reformers are saying the majority is wrong.
Okay.
And they have to change to conform to a higher good.
Right.
Okay, so now, gee, wait a minute. If social contract is the deal, the majority is right by definition.
Okay, but what if they say it's do no harm, the harm principle?
Okay, so, okay, if they say, then what, well, it doesn't change anything at all.
Okay.
If they simply say, okay, we are built on the harm principle, okay, so that means I have no obligation to do good then. I'm just role-playing a little bit.
Okay.
If it's do no harm, I have no obligation to do good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a baby crawling across the street in diapers.
Yeah.
And I'm watching it. I say, hey, wait, hey, watch this, guys. There's going to be a big event here in a moment, and it's going to be ghastly, better than you see on the news.
Okay, good point.
Okay, well, what about the obligation to do good? Okay, how about this? If we just say we got to do good and no harm, what the heck is that? Good and harm are formal categories.
Mm-hmm.
They require detail.
Okay.
They substantive. So what is good? That's the whole point. We got to all do good. Well,
right.
what does it mean to do good?
Yeah,
well, good means that we all agree on it.
Mm-hmm.
But what are we agreeing on? Oh, that we all agree to do the good. You see what I'm saying? Just talking
exactly.
in circles.
And what is it?
What is good? And see, what seems like good in the moment doesn't, it turns out not to be good in the long term.
Right.
There's a reason that we have certain kinds of conventions that have served us well. This is why progressivism misses.
Mm-hmm.
We want to move past what we have learned from time and experience to be a good thing. That is has a salutary impact, but then the good on humankind, but the good then is defined according to a standard, and that's been the Judeo-Christian ethic largely. Human mm-hmm. beings are the kind of creatures that we ought to defend and protect and all that. But
exactly.
Here's
yeah.
another question you can ask. Okay, so there's the social contract. Why am I obliged to obey it?
Yes.
Why am I obliged to obey it? That's it. And what happens if the whole culture gets it wrong? Well, the whole culture can't get it wrong on that definition. So during Nazi Germany, killing Jews, that was the right thing to do for that time.
Yeah, that usually comes up.
Yeah, well, why not? Women?
Yeah.
Okay, women in Sharia countries
mm-hmm.
who are being oppressed. What would be the principled complaint of the person who believed in social contract? Well, that's not right. Well, wait a minute.
Okay.
That's their social contract. Yeah, but people are forced to live to it. Well, yes, that's also part of their contract.
Right.
Well, that's not right. When you say it's not right, what do you mean? Because you just said right was the social contract.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying there's a right outside of the social contract, at least for them? Where did that come from? You see the problems.
I do. Exactly.
Yeah.
And a lot of that went through my head.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Yeah. And I bring up the social reformer because this creates an odd circumstance when the one who is considered the more moral, the social reformer, turns out to be immoral by definition.
Right. Yeah. And I've heard J.P. Moreland, you say that.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the nature of this group, then, you're meeting with in a couple of days?
Well, okay. Up here, we have groups called meetup groups, and there's an array of things that they're involved in.
Okay.
The one I go to at a church was set up by people at the church. However, they're not involved now, and an atheist group up here.
I see.
Non-believers, agnostics,
right.
thinkers, and so forth.
Right.
And now it's mainly the atheists that
that are running
show
the show.
Up.
Okay, let me give you a tip here. I'll tell you something that atheists do virtually every single time they have these discussions, because mm-hmm. they like social contract stuff, because that's kind of like humanist, and it's us all getting together and agreeing we're going to live a certain way for our mutual protection, and they call that human flourishing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I get it. The problem is every single time they smuggle morality into the back door in order to make their case. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. See, like they'll say, well, we have to do what's good for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that word good mean? This is what we're doing. We're trying to define the word good. Oh, well,
right.
The harm principle. All right. What's harm? They haven't improved anything. They just substitute another vague word. And harm has moral content. What is harm? Is it physical pain?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, then we don't allow. or psychological pain? Well, atheist, you're causing me some psychological pain right now. You know?
Yeah.
So do you see, and that isn't, it's kind of a little quip there, but it's serious.
Okay.
When you just throw out these formal categories that kind of presume a moral standard already, you haven't solved the problem. You've just kicked the can down the street. Okay.
Good point.
And it also shows that these broad categories don't solve anything because they have to be invested with particular detail. So what does human flourishing look like? You know, the nuclear family, that's flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
Not the new thing. But people aren't going to want to say, well, that means you're telling people they can't have sex whoever they want to. That's not flourishing. So now you have a difference of opinion
right.
about what flourishing is. These are the problems with social contract.
Okay.
Ways of looking at it.
Good point.
So, anyway, we've written about this in the book. I don't know if
I have the book.
You have the relativism book?
Yes.
Oh, dynamite.
I haven't read it in a long time, but I still have
okay,
it.
You might do a review.
I will.
There's the chapter, I can't remember the total chapter titles offhand now, but the issue is what I call in the book, Society Says Relativism. Society Says Relativism. In other words, morality is whatever the society says it is. And this is what you'll read about the reformer's dilemma and a number of other liabilities. Which society, by the way? You mean Christian society or do you mean progressive society?
Yeah.
Or do you mean atheist human society? Who gets to make those calls?
Okay. It'll be interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Good points.
Okay.
Greg.
Thank you, Richard. Maybe after you're done, give me a call in a couple of weeks. Tell me how it went. All
okay.
right.
Okay, I'll try to do that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you're
everything.
Welcome. I appreciate the call. What this just underscores is that book that Frank Beckwith and I wrote, now we're pushing 21 years ago, is still really timely and is available at Stand to Reason, Relativism. What's that? What?
It's going to be on sale tomorrow.
Oh, thank you. It's going to be on... It's going to be on sale tomorrow from when I'm speaking, which means Amy says it's on sale now when you're listening. So the Relativism book is available, str.org. All right, there we go. What an hour that was. No commercials. Ah, got some work done. It was great being with all of you, and give them heaven, okay? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.